Welcome to the Wisconsin Forward Podcast, a product of the Civic Media Network. I'm your host, Matt Rothschild, and on today's Wisconsin Forward Podcast, we're going to be talking about the upcoming presidential election in our swingiest of states and what's on the line here. But first, a little background about how incredibly close four of the last six presidential races in Wisconsin have been. Back in 2000, Al Gore beat George W. Bush by only 5,708 votes. Then in 2004, John Kerry lost to George W. by only 8,394 votes. Obama then won Wisconsin twice by comfortable margins. But in 2016, Trump beat Hillary Clinton by 22,748 votes. And in 2020, Trump lost to Biden by a similar margin, 20,682 votes. As you can see, close presidential races are nothing new here. They're more the norm than the exception recently, and this one coming up is likely to be a nail-biter too. So let's dive in. Here's Charles Franklin, the director of the Marquette Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy there. This upcoming race looks like another nail-biter. What accounts for this so narrow a difference between the two leading presidential candidates?
I think we just like to be the center of attention, that's all. It's hard to say why in one sense, but as you say, four of those six elections were decided by less than one percentage point and by less than 25,000 votes in all of them. Only the two Obama exceptions stand out to show that the state really can be a landslide under the right circumstances. We've seen partisanship actually, if anything, tighten over the last dozen years, the partisan balance in the state. Back in 2012, we saw the state as about 31% Democratic, 27% Republican. It's now about 30 or 31 Republican, 29 or 30 Democrat, about a one-point Republican advantage. So there has been change in this period, and it's most notably among blue-collar folks, white non-college men in particular have moved from just 3 or 4 points more Republican than Democratic to nearly 24 points more Republican than Democratic.
So, and why do you think that move has happened?
I think it predates Trump, and that's worth pointing to. I think the angst over the Great Recession started it. I think Scott Walker actually skillfully exploited it in his Act 10 period, talking about hardworking taxpayers giving too much to state workers. That was a direct populist kind of appeal to folks. And then Donald Trump arriving on the scene further developed that. But we have seen this growth nationwide in partisan divide by education, especially among, or primarily among, white voters. And that has somewhat flattened out here. In other words, the Republican gains have flattened. They're not continuing to grow. But it does mean that we're in a position where the state is just very evenly balanced. The curious thing is that other states since, say, 2000 or the 1990s have moved either in solidly Democratic or solidly Republican directions. Think of Iowa, for example. It used to be pretty competitive, and now it's solidly Republican. Think of Colorado, that in the late 1990s was a solidly red state, and now it's mostly a Democratic state. We, on the other hand, have shifted, but parts of the state have shifted in a Democratic direction, other parts in a Republican direction. Wisconsin has remained a very competitive state for a long time now, and I think part of that reason is that our partisanship remains pretty evenly balanced. It shifted a little bit to be more competitive rather than less, with a small four-point Democratic advantage in 2012 now being about a one-point Republican advantage in terms of people's partisan identification. But what we have seen is other states in that period have shifted considerably. So think of Iowa has moved from very competitive and even blue-leaning to now solidly Republican. Look at Colorado, which was unanimously Republican control of state government in the 1990s, is now quite a blue state. And yet Wisconsin hasn't. We have seen changes here, though. Parts of the state, especially southeastern Wisconsin and the Milwaukee suburbs, have become less Republican over the last dozen or so years, while the north and west of the state have become more Republican. And so there's a weird balancing out that leaves us still very competitive, even though we are responding to some of the changes you see nationwide in suburban voters, in rural voters, and also small towns and or small cities and larger villages.
So is Wisconsin the swingiest of the swing states?
We're swingy in one sense in that we're so evenly balanced. But for us, a swing is going from 0.7% Trump victory in 16 to 0.6% Biden victory in 2020. So we swing, but only within a very, very narrow range.
And talk to me a little bit more about the suburbs moving more in a Democratic direction in the so-called wow counties around Milwaukee.
We were a little slow to catch on to the suburban movement. There were other suburbs in big metro areas around the country where the suburbs had been moving in a Democratic direction prior to us. As of 2012, our suburbs, and most prominently the three counties around Milwaukee, Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington counties, the WOW counties, those remained very solidly Republican in 2010 in Walker's election, also in 2012 in Mitt Romney's election. But since 2012, the WOW counties in particular have become less and less Republican. They're still Republican majorities, but by maybe 10 or 12 points less than they were in 2010 and 2012. And that decline occurred for Donald Trump in 2016. He got less vote than Romney did there. He got even less in 2020. But it also occurred with Scott Walker, whose base had been the WOW counties, but his support in those counties declined in 14, declined again in 18. Ron Johnson, senator, declines in each of his elections in those counties. So this is a widespread shift. And at the presidential level, it means that those three counties are now giving Republicans about 40,000 fewer votes, net votes, than they did in 2012. When you think of our statewide races being decided by less than 25,000 votes, a shift of 40,000 in those counties is a big problem for Republicans. They'd be losing statewide if it were not for the north and west, the rural parts of the state, moving in a Republican direction, kind of balancing out the changes in the suburbs.
And what accounts for the shift? Why are they moving in the Democratic direction?
You know, this is a bit of a mystery. There's certainly the obvious part about whether Donald Trump's style of Republican leadership fits well with the classic country club Republicans of the suburbs. And again, we see this across the country. It's not just here. I think the issue focus, the kinds of things that the modern Trump Republican Party focuses on are rather different from the issues that the Paul Ryan Republican Party used to focus on. And you don't have to look further than the schism between Ryan and the Republican Party here in the state as well as nationally to see how much that shifted.
Ryan's not going to vote for Trump, he says.
So he says. And, you know, and this was the vice presidential nominee of the party in 2012. Though, for that matter, Mitt Romney's not particularly welcome at Republican functions these days either. So there's just been a massive shift in the tenor of the Republican Party, in who's in fashion and who's out of fashion, and what issues are at the core of the party anymore. It used to be strong defense, free market, reduced government regulation, and social conservatism. Some of that's still there. The social conservatism, if anything, has gotten stronger in the party. But commitment to free trade is out the door. Also, of course, there are a lot of Democrats that didn't like free trade either. So there's a big shift. But it also means that, at least at the rhetorical style level, things about good business practices and strong defense are not nearly as prominent today as they used to be. And I think Republican voters here and elsewhere are adjusting to that, some becoming more intensely Republican, others being turned off by the direction of the party.
And I think some have been turned off by the tenor of the politics, the far-right tenor, the hostile attitude. This is a through line from Walker to Trump. And that turned off, I think, a lot of women, independent women, moderate Republican women in the suburbs around Milwaukee. And I think Trump is doing the same. And the abortion issue, of course, crystallized that in a lot of their minds.
It's absolutely true. And certainly the abortion issue is a good example where a consensus among Republicans prior to the Dobbs decision in the summer of 2022 that struck down Roe versus Wade has meant a lot of Republicans now face an issue where in the past being pro-life was a consensus position within the party. To now there are divisions about how much to emphasize that, at what age of gestation to ban abortions, what exceptions to make. So there's new division in the party over this issue, where in the past it was easy to pay lip service to being pro-life without needing to settle on actual policies, because Roe versus Wade was the law of the land and it limited what could actually be done. Now that you actually see the opportunities for Republican legislatures around the country and governors to sign either very restrictive laws or less restrictive laws, or in Democratic places, very pro-abortion rights laws, that has really shifted the way that issue plays within the party to be more of a divisive issue than a unifying issue.
Some economists like Paul Krugman, they keep saying, look, the macro figures are great. Biden's done a really good job on the economy. And yet people, when they're polled, don't like the economy. Is that because their own personal circumstances are not good or precarious? Or is their personal circumstance good and they're reading everybody saying the economy's bad?
It's really tricky, because Krugman and many, virtually all economists are right that the macroeconomic indicators of unemployment and even real wages look pretty good right now. There was definitely a hit of inflation in 21 and 22, which briefly lowered real wages, but those have recovered now. But I don't think people have adjusted to the new inflated prices of things. The price index is up about 19% from when Biden took office. Wages have risen to match that now, and more than match it over that time.
This was part of a conversation I had with Charles Franklin way back in May, and I caught up with him again in October after Kamala Harris and Tim Walz had become the nominees of the Democratic Party, and after he'd done his most recent poll showing Kamala Harris still ahead. Charles, what are you seeing in your most recent poll?
Harris by 4, 52 to 48. That's the same as it was in the beginning of the month, early September. That's also up from where she was when she first got in the race. In July, we had Trump up by 1 with registered voters, but we had Harris up by 1 with likely voters. Now it's a 4-point margin for Harris with both registered and with likely voters. We just didn't see very much change between early September, which was the week after the Democratic convention, and late September, which was the week after the debate. And so in both of these cases, we just didn't see a whole lot of movement other than what we saw from July to early September. Personal characteristics of the candidates are pretty stable, too.
The thing that impresses me about Harris in this poll and in the last one is that she's over the magic 50 mark. I mean, she's at 52%. And a lot of times campaign folks and their own pollsters say if you get over 50%, you're pretty good. And here she's standing still at 52%, which is, you know, more than 50 plus one.
Well, that's right. Though, in fairness, now, we ask people if they'd vote for Harris or Trump, or haven't they decided? And about 6% say they haven't decided. We then ask the undecideds, if you had to choose, who would you vote for? And that's where you get the 52-48 with
almost nobody who says, no, I really can't choose. Still, she's been running in the upper 40s or over 50 in the multi-candidate race. She's also a four-point lead, 48 to 44 with registered voters, or 49 to 44 with likely voters. So you can see that she's, if not at 50, she's in that high 40 range.
Charles, can you also talk about the candidates' favorability numbers?
For Harris, it's a net negative 3, 47 favorable to 50 unfavorable. Trump's a negative 11, 44 to 55.
Charles, it's hard for a presidential candidate to win with a negative 11 unfavorability to favorability. Has there been a, in your memory, a presidential candidate who was able to win that far negative?
Yeah, his name was Donald Trump.
How bad negative was he then?
He was worse than 11. I think it was in the high teens, but Hillary was in the low teens or high single digits. 2016 was the first race since the 70s when pollsters first started asking the favorability question, in which both candidates were net negative for most of the campaign. Trump considerably more than Clinton, but as we saw, that wasn't actually what determined the outcome. So you'd certainly rather be at minus 3 than minus 11. But I don't think you can take that minus 11 to the bank when you look at the history of Trump, including in 2020 when he just barely lost Wisconsin, but had a solidly net negative rating then as well.
Charles, one of the things that popped out at me when I was watching you this noon giving your presentation on these new numbers was independents. They're moving in Harris's direction and Tammy's. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and this is, I think, one of the more interesting changes that we've seen in the last two polls. In the winter and spring, independents were favoring Trump over Biden by a little bit. And since Harris got in the race, they were pretty evenly divided in July. But now in both the early September and the late September polls, they're favoring Harris with about 61 or 62 or 3% of the vote. Hmm. And so that's a notable move. Now, independents can change their minds. I say they're fickle. But now we've got two polls in a row that are showing them at around 60 for Harris. So I still wouldn't swear that they won't move before the end. But we've seen them going for Trump earlier in the year. We've seen them evenly divided. And now we see that significant advantage for Harris with them and two polls in a row. In the Senate race, they've also moved. They were always more favorable to Baldwin, but now they are also in the 60% range for Baldwin. So a little bit of a move there. Generally, I would say they are contributing to why Harris is up 4 now instead of maybe tied or up 1, is that movement. Democrats are nearly unanimous behind Harris and are very close to unanimous behind Baldwin. Republicans, a little less so. There's still 5 or 8% crossover from Republicans to either of the Democratic candidates. But the independents are shifting the race a bit in the Democratic direction right now.
Can you talk, Charles, about enthusiasm? I know Trump was in the state bragging about he's got all the enthusiasm. That's not what your number showed.
No, but he's got a lot of enthusiasm. early in the year, Republicans were outpacing Democrats by 15 or more points on enthusiasm. When Biden dropped out, Democrats shot up 22%. Republicans went up by 7 points, I believe it was, in that same period. And then Democrats went up again in early September after the convention and have held basically flat. They're down 1 point this time. But Republicans had kind of moved up after their convention and then flat, but now they've moved up again so that it's 71% of Democrats very enthusiastic to 67 for Republicans. So a close margin there and a reversal of the big Republican lead early in the year. And back to those independents, half of them now say they're very enthusiastic. That's up from the mid-30s earlier.
So this suggests we're going to have a huge turnout again, don't you think?
I think we are looking at something like 2020. Whether we quite reach those levels is always a mystery, I think. But when enthusiasm was 15 or 20 points below where it had been in 2020 back in the spring, I was thinking we really might see a drop-off in turnout. Now, with this higher enthusiasm, I would guess we're awfully close to the 3.3 million that we saw in 2020.
I want to thank Charles Franklin for that very perceptive analysis of presidential politics in Wisconsin and the current lay of the land in the presidential race that is so close here. And now I want to give some perspective, or grab some perspective, on how crucial this election is, not only for Wisconsin, but for the country as a whole, what it would mean if Trump were actually to win. And for that perspective, I'm turning now to Todd Alba, host of the Todd Alba Show on Civic Media. Todd, tell me why this race is so significant, this presidential race. What does it mean for this country if, for instance, Donald Trump were to win?
Well, there's a lot of things right on the table, but I think most specifically, I think each voter should ask themselves, what does it mean to me, for women in particular, or any male who cares about a woman, and the reproductive rights and the personal freedoms? Just like a lot of us who like to pheasant or turkey hunt wouldn't want government telling us how many shotguns we can own to go turkey hunting, women don't want, surprise, surprise, government telling them how to control their bodies. And that's what we're talking about here. And so I think that people have to ask themselves, not just as a country, what's at stake? There's a lot at stake. What is at stake for me personally? So if you're someone who's a woman who cares about women with their healthcare rights, if you happen to be LGBTQ or know someone in that community, what is their life going to be like? Like myself, if you have people in your family who are of Latino heritage or mixed heritage, we're talking about potentially those folks being deported, rounded up and deported for why they look like, or in my godson's case, their mother is a naturalized citizen from El Salvador. We're talking about her citizenship being revoked potentially, but these are things we're talking about in Project 2025. So to put it succinctly, the fundamental tenets of American democracy and freedom are at stake. And as Joe Biden likes to say, that's not hyperbole. It's not a joke. It really isn't. And I know it seems far-fetched because people say, well, the courts will take care of it. Well, thus far, the Supreme Court does not have a stellar record in quote unquote taking care of it. In fact, they've allowed Donald Trump to have immunity for these things that he did while president. So that's why each and every vote matters so much. And like Liz Cheney said here recently in Wisconsin, as a longtime, lifelong Republican and conservative, she's never voted for a Democrat before. She is proudly casting her vote for Kamala Harris. And she gets it because she's seen all the evidence, classified and unclassified, in those bipartisan January 6th committee hearings.
And when Trump says he wants to be dictator on day one, just for one day, but dictator on day one, and wants to get rid of parts of the Constitution if necessary, doesn't that send shivers down your spine?
Yeah, it's like I say, it's unthinkable, I think, for a lot of us. But as Maya Angelou said, to paraphrase, when somebody shows you who they are, believe them. And Donald Trump, as you look, and that's the other thing I would ask your listeners to ask themselves. As we get under 30 days now to this election, Kamala Harris comes to Wisconsin and talks about American exceptionalism, talking about having, our better days are still ahead, being a president for all Americans. And Donald Trump comes to Wisconsin and talks about negativity and an election that happened 4 years ago that former House Speaker Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin, has said Donald Trump lost the election, Joe Biden won the election, and Donald Trump is still trying to litigate that in Wisconsin, claiming that it was rigged and unfair, which it wasn't. It's just more lies. And recently saying it's dangerous to openly be a Harris supporter because, quote, you might get hurt, unquote. Think about the rhetoric of these two people, Harris versus Trump. Who is appealing to our better angels? Who is being inclusive? Who is offering a path forward? And who is looking to the past and being narcissistic and quite frankly, dangerous?
Yeah, fomenting violence.
Mm-hmm. Remind folks, be a voter. be a voter, because it really does come down to each and every vote. This is going to be probably one of the closest, I know we say this every time, but most likely one of the closest elections of our lifetime.
And most pivotal ones, too. Yeah. Todd, thanks so much. With me now is Dom Salvia, host of the Dom Salvia Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Dom, I wanted to get your input on why you think this election is so crucial and what's at risk this time around.
Hey, Matt, thanks for having me, and I appreciate it. This is a scary time. You know, it's really concerned me when I see, you know, leaders in the Republican Party and candidates in the Republican Party that are not able or not willing to articulate that, yes, in fact, Donald Trump lost the last election. And we're this far into it. I mean, you know, we're very close to the next election, and they still can't admit to themselves or won't, because out of fear of reprisal from apparently the leader of the MAGA party. And that bodes very poorly for this democracy. Knowing that as the background, knowing that we already experienced violence on January 6th, and knowing what the kind of rhetoric that is getting deeper and darker coming from Donald Trump, I have a very real fear for migrants in this country, for LGBTQ people in this country, for women in this country. As the vice president has said, Matt, this is literally about freedom. Freedom, democracy, yeah, that's at stake literally in this election.
I mean, people who don't study history don't understand how fragile democracies can be. I mean, the democracy in Chile died in a night, and tens of thousands of people died and were tortured. We know the lesson of Nazi Germany. But then when we have Donald Trump running to be dictator on day one, yeah, saying, you know, he can terminate parts of the Constitution, I mean, I take him at his word.
Yes.
And it scares the bejesus out of me, really. How do you feel on that?
Well, I absolutely take him on his word on that. And it's not just Donald Trump, of course. And that's the scary thing about this. And I fully believe that Donald Trump will lose this election. And I fully believe that Donald Trump will say he won this election. He and the MAGAs, no matter what happens, they will think they were screwed. They will think that somehow it was stolen from them. I mean, if he's the only one that can fix it, and the only way that he could possibly lose is because the Democrats cheat, well, what does that say? I mean, you don't believe in democracy if you only believe it when you win the election.
So what do you see happening if he loses, which I sure hope he does? Then how do you see it playing out?
I think there will be an effort by Donald Trump. I'm not going to say similar to January 6th, but I think he can't not have some sort of action. But I think depending on the size of the loss, he will be greatly diminished. And hopefully we can put a cigarette out on this terrible time in our electoral history. Could there be another January 6th? Absolutely. I mean, there still hasn't been a consequence, at least for Donald Trump, for the last January 6th. So, I mean, he has a history of doing this.
Yeah, but this time he's not in charge of the military. This
right.
time he's not in charge of the Justice Department. So he has much less means at his disposal. He could tell the Proud Boys and his other MAGA militaristic friends to go out in the street with their weapons, but ultimately I don't think they're going to prevail.
I don't think they're going to get the permit to do the meeting on the Ellipse. You know, I don't think that's going to be forthcoming. So I'm super hopeful that they will be diminished. I hope that it's a bigger margin than it certainly seems to be right now. I mean anything can happen. I mean, this is a very strange election season. But I think if there is a resounding defeat for Donald Trump, if Kamala Harris comes in and just kicks his ass, I think that will take the wind of a lot of sails of these, you know, those who so casually discuss, you know, civil war and purging and those kinds of terms. I think if the American people stand up and reject us wholeheartedly, that will take some of the wind out of their sails.
Well, from your mouth to God's ear, I hope that happens. Thanks, Dom, for your insights and your passion about what's at stake in this presidential race. And now I'm going to turn to Maggie Dawn, host of the Maggie Dawn Show, for her own perspective. Maggie, I wanted to get your input on this conversation I'm having about what's at stake in this election. How scared are you that Trump might win? What would happen if Trump actually wins? Where are you on that?
It's sort of a daily emotional temperature check, if you will. Some days I do better than others. There are some days where that I am more fearful than hopeful. And on other days, it's the inverse. But the actual contemplation of what Donald Trump this time around would mean is very frightening, right? So I'm risk adjusting in two buckets, right? What is the risk that he actually wins? And then if he wins, what is the risk that's posed by a Donald Trump second timer on the dance floor? And I kind of combine those two and say, okay, so what's my overall risk? When I combine the two, though I put the probability of all of that happening at less than 50%, it's not substantially less than 50%. And that less than 50% chance risk, or slightly less than 50% chance risk that he wins, bears with it such enormous negative downside potential that far outstrips, I think, anything I've ever lived through. There is no historical analogy in my 47 years. And I say that because while I lived through the first Trump presidency term, this time around, there's no one from the A team, right? Like anybody with any kind of integrity or true sense of their oath to the Constitution, of duty, of respect for law and order, or even respect for traditional conservative Republican principles, has been expelled, expunged, erased, or has run from the MAGA cult. And so what you're left with are sycophants, self-interested actors that are willing to do or say whatever to increase their profile, access, and power, and people who, frankly, are not the best and brightest around, even within conservatism. There are very, very smart and, I think, well-meaning conservatives. They ain't going to be part of Trump 2.0. So just the idea that you're going to basically have the JV squad of sycophants, amoralists, right, and people acting in an incredibly transactional way, right? You put all that together and you turbocharge it with this Supreme Court that seems to be happy to bend its knee and drive its knife into the heart of our democracy. We need only look at the immunity ruling. Like, okay, well, presidents are kings. And just the deck is stacked in such an ominous way.
Recognizing this dangerous combination, Maggie Dawn, what do you tell your listeners? What do you tell people you know who oddly may still be on the fence? I don't know how they can sit on the fence at this point. But what do you tell them, a kind of elevator talk about what to do now?
Yeah, but the elevator pitch, the quick one is, listen, to save our democracy, if we care about that, the only way to do that is through our democracy. It is going to require you to make a choice that you may not particularly like your options about. That's okay. That's what adults do every day. It's okay to feel torn, because I assume if I'm talking to somebody that really hasn't made up their mind, they're torn. And I'm not going to call that bad faith. I'm going to say, all right, I believe your place of being torn is totally legit. And I feel that. Let's help work through that. What kind of information do you need? What would persuade you? And then at the end of the day, if we believe in this experiment and you believe that the middle class is the backbone of this country and you truly want to engage in those issues and you believe in law and order, take the time to look at it. And on November 5th, look deep into your heart, go into that ballot box, that polling place, and cast your ballot where your heart tells you to cast it. Because at the end of the day, I cannot give up hope that the greatness of this country will always remain in its people. And again, to save our democracy this time around, we must do that through that very democracy. And to do so unafraid and unafraid to join issue and to have discussions, but to ask one another, our neighbors and our friends and our coworkers and the people that we don't maybe necessarily agree with on everything, to look into your heart and go vote on November 5th.
Thanks, Maggie, for that very powerful statement about all that is at stake right now as we're preparing to vote in this most momentous presidential election. Thanks for listening to this episode of Wisconsin Forward. If you like the podcast, please subscribe to the show on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or your favorite podcast platform. Learn more about the show and download episodes right from the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us. Coming up next time, we talk about the gerrymandering saga that took place right here in Wisconsin, going back to how the state got some of the most gerrymandered maps in the nation, the battle to unrig the maps, and where we stand now with analysis from Jay Heck of Common Cause, Carlene Beshin, great statewide grassroots organizer, Nick Ramos of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and Dan Schaefer of the Recombobulation Area and Civic Media.